This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
As an investor wants a well-balanced portfolio. They may want stocks, they may want commodities, they may want fixed income. All of that can be accomplished by buying an ETF.
Dipping one's toe into a new pond can often mean getting accustomed to a whole new set of acronyms. Well, if you're treading into the investment world for the first time, here's one you should know, the ETF, or exchange-traded fund. This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn about the ETF market from John Mayer, the Chief Investment Officer of Global X ETFs. ETFs are one of the largest segments of the financial services industry, even though many of us don't know the first thing about them. We discuss how ETFs work, what has helped propel them into a $10 trillion industry, and how monitoring ETFs lends insight into trends such as the future of electric vehicles in China. Then we revisit our 2021 discussion with impact investment pioneer Raj Thamathram about how the socially responsible investing field has changed over the years. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend John Mayer. John is the Chief Investment Officer at Global X ETFs. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for having me on.
So I wanted to have an expert on about the exploding ETF market. We've never really covered it here at Sea Change Radio, and it's a very popular investment tool. And I thought, who better to have on than you? So why don't you first explain to our listeners what an exchange-traded fund is, what these ETFs are, and why they've grown in popularity so much.
Sure. Thanks, Alex. ETFs stand for exchange-traded funds. And the size of the global ETF market currently is about $10 trillion. If you just look at the U.S., it's approximately $7 trillion. In comparison to the mutual fund industry, that size in the U.S. is about $26 trillion. And when I started doing this 20 years ago or so, the market was very new. People, even if they're very educated or well-versed in finance, they don't necessarily know what an ETF is, but they probably own it. So an ETF trades like a stock. An ETF you'll find on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, and you can trade it throughout the day. Typically, they're index funds, so they follow a defined index with defined rules. There are active ETFs and there's commodity ETFs. So it's not an absolute index that it follows, but for the most part, they're index funds.
And how does an ETF differ from a mutual fund, John?
How it differs than, say, a mutual fund. A mutual fund is a collection of stocks or securities that you only can buy at the end of the day. So you can put your order in at 12 o'clock, but it's not going to be executed till the end of the day. Now, with an ETF, you can trade it throughout the day. Now, there's some there are differences in terms of taxes. If you buy a mutual fund, say in October, and the fund has done rather well, there's a good chance you're going to get a capital gains distribution. And if you bought it in October, you didn't really participate in the appreciation for the entire year. You just bought it in October. And then you might get this capital gains distribution, and you have to pay taxes on it. With an ETF, for the most part, the tax consequence usually is zero on the fund level because of the structure of in-kind transfers. So when you create shares, you're adding stocks into the trust. When you're redeeming shares, you're taking them out of the trust. So there's no actual sale that goes on inside of the trust when there's redemptions. And also the portfolio manager can do some tax management with inside of the structure. And there another difference would be expenses. Mutual funds typically are a lot more expensive than ETFs. So you look at ETFs, they trade during the day, they're cheaper, and they typically don't provide a meaningful amount of capital gains distribution, much better structure, and assets have grown meaningfully over time.
And when you talk about portfolio managers, one of the things that a lot of people research before they invest in a mutual fund is who's the portfolio manager, what are their values, what's their track record, etc. What kind of role does the portfolio manager play in an ETF?
For the most part, let's assume that you think about ETFs as index funds. And the ETF tracks an underlying index, like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or the Russell 2000, or there's thousands of them. And you can judge a manager of how well the ETF tracks the underlying index. Is there minimal tracking error to the underlying index? And that's a good thing. So on that level, you can somewhat judge a portfolio manager from one company to another. There are active ETFs out there, which are more analogous to mutual funds in the sense that you do have a manager that's actively trading and the underlying mandate doesn't follow an index. And in that case, sure, you can track the manager and how well they're doing. There's a transparency component, which I didn't mention, about ETFs. You know at all times what's in that ETF. It's a list of securities held inside the trust as provided on a daily basis. That's why ETFs don't trade at a premium or a discount. The price of the shares don't trade at a premium or discount to their underlying NAV for any meaningful amount of time because it can be arbed out.
So for ESG investors, ESG standing for environment, social, governance, these socially responsible investors, environmentally friendly focused investors, let's say, the transparency of an ETF is probably pretty appealing, I would guess.
Well, I mean, ESG is a whole category unto itself, and it's a newer component in the investing world. And there's such a large definition of what ESG is. But yeah, the transparency of the structure, you know what every security that's held inside the trust on a daily basis. So you can say, I don't want to own certain types of companies. I don't want to own companies that I believe are polluting the environment or perhaps are making guns and you don't like those type of companies. Sure, you could see if those companies are inside the index. Chances are, unless it's an ESG index, chances are it'll be inside that trust.
So can you explain a little bit in greater detail what your company does in the ETF space, John? Do you assemble these ETFs on your own? What's your business model?
GlobalX is an ETF provider in the U.S., Australia, Brazil. We have a European business, so we live up to the name Global. In the U.S., we have, keeps growing, we have approximately 95 ETFs, exchange-traded funds. And these ETFs invest in different areas. We have thematic ETFs. Thematics can include something like cloud computing, financial technology, electric vehicles, battery makers, robotics, and artificial intelligence. So roughly half our assets are in the thematic space, the disruption space, things that are industries that are changing the paradigm, changing how we are doing business, how we are operating as a society, how we're communicating with each other. And depending on which type of theme, whether it be financial technology, moving into the blockchain technology, how is that impacting the traditional banks? And how is that technology changing those banks? And then we also have a group of ETFs that are focused on income. We've been in a very low interest rate environment for quite some time. While interest rates are moving up, they're still historically low. So we have different types of funds that are equity-based for the most part that provide a higher level of income that investors are looking for, particularly with changing demographics and an aging population. And as people retire, they need more consistent dividends. And we have a whole group of ETFs that fall into that category. We also have international ETFs, China consumer ETFs, different China sectors in China, as well as many other countries, whether it be Nigeria, Colombia, Portugal. I'm tired of hearing about the IPO, all of the ways that all the cash could go. It would be nice if it would trickle down to the people on the other side of town. But something tells me that they probably won't, because something tells me that they just ain't.
protection for the 1%. Out of the pockets of the 99. So close your eyes and cover up your ears. This ain't the message that you came to hear. But I can't help it if I just don't care. I don't want to be a billionaire. Into outer space. No, 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 no. Okay, no school teachers are living ways. I know nothing's gonna come from.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to John Mayer. He is the Chief Investment Officer for Global X ETFs. So, speaking of some of these disruptive industries, let's turn to the EV market, the electric vehicle space. Specifically, I'm thinking about how China is adopting electric vehicles in record numbers now, and it's really transforming the global market for EVs, and we're seeing supply chain issues in things like lithium batteries. What can we glean from the ETF markets about China's transition to electric vehicles, John?
Well, first, let's look at why there's been such great adoption of electric vehicles in China. China is very close to the supply chains. So that, I think, is a big driver of the adoption. And the adoption has been about 53% of all cars sold in China are EV sales.
That's in 2021, right?
2021. In comparison, the U.S. penetration is approximately 5%. And being close to the supply chain, combined with incentives from the government, as well as a need to bring down pollution, particularly in, say, Beijing, this is all catapulted sales in China. Now, if you think about how it impacts the rest of the world, well, you look at the U.S. We only have about a 5% penetration, but we just had a bill that was passed in Congress and signed by Biden that is really going to help the transition to clean energy. There's a lot of incentives in that bill that will, whether it be tax credits for individuals buying EVs, charging stations, the push forward to, rejigger factories to make them more environmentally friendly. There's a lot of components of that bill which will drive a lot of other businesses. So it's projected that $3.5 trillion will be spent alongside that bill over the next 10 years that will help move us towards a cleaner energy transition. And with that, you'll get a greater adoption of electric vehicles. I think that's a big play from this bill. Now, in terms of the ETFs, my company has a couple ETFs that focus on whether it be lithium production and battery production, or the companies that utilize batteries and sell electric cars. So there's two ways to kind of play that. You can play the commodity component, lithium. Lithium is in short supply, and it's in great demand. So obviously prices are going up. It takes a while to mine lithium. And going back to China, while they're closer to the supply chain or own some of these lithium companies. So that's very helpful.
And can we kind of connect the dots with what you were just saying and figure out if there's going to be a stranglehold with U.S. adoption because of this boom in China? Can we see signs from the ETF market that, let's say, a particular rare earth mining ETF has gone off the charts? Something that tells me that American consumers are not going to be able to afford Tesla batteries for their solar, rooftop solar systems or whatever, because I know those have almost doubled in the last couple of years. Little pieces of this puzzle can throw everything off.
Biden's historic climate bill, I think, benefits two key areas. One is electric vehicles and one is solar. And that's because some of the tax credits that the consumer will receive. Now, this innovation was already started. I mean, there is obviously Tesla has 60% of the EV market, but there's a lot of new players coming into the market. Rivian, as well as many of the other mainstream players are all producing electric vehicles. And some of them are expensive. They become cheaper with the tax credits. But there are less expensive EVs. And as the distance traveled on a battery charge increases, I think the usage will increase and the tax credits help. And I don't think it's too dissimilar on the solar side, because there's been this driving force towards clean energy for the past decade, and some of the tax incentives will help going forward. And energy prices are so high.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to John Mayer. He is the CIO, the Chief Investment Officer for Global X ETFs. So, John, at the outset, you were putting the ETF, the exchange-traded fund market, in context and giving us an idea of just how big it is. I think you said it's over $10 trillion. Can you give us an idea of how the demographics have evolved in this space? I imagine it started off with a much younger group of investors, and now it's become more mainstream, comparable to the way, let's say, mutual funds evolved from the 70s to the late 90s.
Well, I think I would look at it a little bit differently, Alex. So if you think about some of the original ETFs that came into the market, SPY, MDY. SPY is an ETF that tracks the S&P 500. It is the single most, or the largest single security that exists on planet Earth, SPY. And it was created primarily for use by institutions to either monetize cash, to just park in an exposure while they're looking for something else, do quick trades. And it was a very efficient way to buy a basket of 500 securities. Out of SPY came others, something similar on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, one on the Mid-Cap Index, one on the NASDAQ.
So what year are we talking about here, John?
1993 was the first ETF, and that was SPY. And since then, right now, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, we have over 2,000 ETFs in the U.S. Now, at first, they were fashioned after major indexes and well-utilized indexes. And there was a large amount of institutional use. And over time, there became more and more ETFs that tracked many different indexes, and indexes were created so that an ETF could follow that index. And there was an education process to financial advisors to how to effectively use these ETFs. So one of the big things that I do is create portfolios at Global X. So what I do is I take many different ETFs and put them together based off a client's risk tolerance and time horizon. I have these incredible tools. I call them like almost fintech instruments that I utilize, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, because they're very tax efficient. The fees are generally lower than a mutual fund, and they're transparent. I know what's inside of these.
Right. So can you tailor one for the fossil-free sector or the gun-free sector, like you said earlier?
Well, I can tailor a portfolio and pick an ETF that best fits a particular client's profile, using these pieces, these building blocks, these Lego pieces, to build a broader portfolio. As an investor wants a well-balanced portfolio. They may want stocks, they may want commodities, they may want fixed income. All of that can be accomplished by buying an ETF.
So the ESG space, the environment, social, governance sector, which for a long time was called corporate social responsibility or just the green investing space, but now it's known by this moniker ESG. How do you have more capability or flexibility to be able to create ESG-focused instruments for investors, John?
Well, the ESG topic is broad, and we could go on for weeks and weeks discussing it. But in terms of an exchange-traded fund, and in creating an exchange-traded fund or using one, there's two main ways to look at this space. One is looking at through an exclusionary screen. So there's different providers, whether it be MSCI or S&P or Russell, that'll screen companies for things like equality. Are they making things that are harmful to the environment? And they could take them out of those companies out of an index. So say you have the S&P 500, but there could be 50 or 60 companies by your definition of what ESG is, which it does vary. Those companies should not be included in this because they are not considered ESG. So that's one way of creating an index, excluding companies. Another way would be to start from the bottom up, including companies that meet certain values. You look at different stakeholders. You look at employees, suppliers, stockholders, customers, and do some sort of survey to find out the companies that, by your definition for this index, should be included in that index. So you're looking, it's a deeper dive and a harder and more comprehensive way of including companies within an index. So those are two ways that you can create indexes and then use an ETF to replicate that index within the ESG space.
He's the Chief Investment Officer of Global X ETFs, John Mayer. John, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was a lot of fun.
I'm joined on SeaChange Radio by Raj Thermatharam. He is one of the pioneers of the responsible investment field in the UK. He's a board director and senior advisor to several nonprofits in the space. Raj, welcome back to SeaChange Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex. I'm very pleased to be back.
As I mentioned, you're one of the earliest experts in the responsible investing field. It's changed names many times. Why don't you first summarize the arc and the evolution of the space briefly, if you can?
Well, that's a great starter question. So in most countries, it started off as a ethical or personal values or personal morals based thing. And so, for example, in the USA, I think most people first heard about it in relation to apartheid South Africa and not investing in that. That can also be extended to dealing with tobacco or any other sector or company that individuals don't like. From there, it morphed a bit, as you were saying, into something which was more institutional or retail as a product, and then it became known as socially responsible investing, where people start, investment professionals started to look for good companies, best in class is the technical jargon, companies that are doing better, even if they're in a dirty sector. So, for example, without naming names, you can look for fossil fuel companies which are trying to support the Paris Agreement and invest in those and disinvest or divest from companies who haven't. That's probably the most extreme example of the challenge in terms of finding best in class. And then most recently, we've had a range of other players come into the sector who are looking for alpha, for outperformance. So people are trying to integrate non-financial or extra-financial data into their traditional investment performance processes to find a competitive advantage.
And you've been a senior advisor at organizations like the university's superannuation scheme, which is a large UK-based pension fund. But that was a while ago. Get us up to date with how larger behemoths of the investment world, whether they be pension funds or hedge funds, private equity, how are they adopting ESG into their vocabulary, Raj?
Great question. When I joined the responsible investment field, I was one of a relatively small number, a handful of professionals in large organizations. Mine was a big pension fund called the University Superannuation Scheme. It's the UK equivalent to TIA CREF in the States. And from there, I went to be the head of ESG or of responsible investment at AXA, which is a very big global insurance-based fund manager. since that time, we've had organizations like BlackRock and State Street and private equity firms like KKR all signing up to being members of an organization called the Principles of Responsible Investment. So depending on how you classify it, between 1 in 3 or even 1 in 2 investment dollars is now signed up to those principles on paper. How in practice that gets executed is a very big question. There's a lot of concern about greenwashing.
Yes, I can't help but think a lot of times when I hear the stats being bandied about that the ESG sector has gone from $150 billion to $2 trillion in the last how many years, I can't help but think that that's just that they're moving the goalposts a lot in many cases, that these companies aren't necessarily completely changing the way they do business, but the way we analyze green investing has changed. Is that overly harsh?
So I'm going to say yes and no. The concern is absolutely right. I have been talking about it for over 10 years. It's one reason why I went independent and set up my own think tank. It's much easier to say what you think when you're not wearing an organizational hat. So where you're absolutely right, Alex, is that it's very easy to slap a label of ESG on a fund, which isn't very different from the funds that didn't used to be called ESG. So you do a tiny bit of divestment, you take out tobacco here, you overweight companies which have a good carbon footprint, and suddenly, wham, bam, you've got a ESG fund. Well, actually, the real world value of that is pretty minimal, if anything. So that's one problem. The other problem is a lot of very big fund managers are doing what they do best, which is to push products. So on top of their normal business, they've added a new set of products called ESG products. Well, that's a bit like, I don't know, having some extra salad, but at the same time stuffing yourself with high carb fizzy drinks and unhealthy food. It doesn't change the real impact of those organizations. And so I have some big questions about the greenwashing that's allowed in the sector at the moment.
Raj Thermathiram, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters and Theo Katzman. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.